You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. On February 13th, KBOO kicked off our All Thrills, No Frills special programming drive. Everything you hear on KBOO in its own way is special programming because we are a volunteer-powered, member-driven community radio station, and we need your support to keep it going. Information on that special programming can be found on KBOO's website homepage, kboo.fm. This morning, I do want to encourage listeners to support KBOO radio and programs like The Old Mole. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give. While we aren't in the station to take your calls these days, you can show your support by giving online. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44-321, or you can support the Postal Service and Community Radio by mailing your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast Avenue in Portland. Support KBOO, support Community Radio today. And now it's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour with host Desiree Helgers.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, bringing you news and views from a socialist, feminist, decolonizing perspective. I'm Desiree Helgers, and I'm your host for this V-Day show. And that was a little opening reminder from the late, great Edwin Starr that we need way more love and way less war in this world. So let's all take a little time this week to give the White House and your representatives a call and tell Joe Biden that we're too busy paying for the last few wars for him to be starting another one already. How about we change things up and instead of spending trillions on war and weapons, we invest in universal health care, housing for all, and public education? V-Day is a good day to remind ourselves that militarism, white supremacy, police violence, and violence against women, queer, and trans people, and especially women, queer, and trans people of color, are inextricably linked. I'm going to go out on a limb and say police in the U.S. already have enough surplus military equipment to go around. Coming up on today's show, Bill Resnick talks to James Offsink of the organization Portland Forward, part of Portland's Police Reform Coalition, about the draft police association contract, which was just released and will be up for discussion and possibly a vote in City Council on Thursday the 17th. They discuss the last few years of reform struggles in Portland and continuing possibilities for reconstructing policing. Next, we home in on the 5th anniversary of the police shooting of Quanis Moose Hayes, which was marked this past Wednesday by a special all-day screening of the film Silent Voices, written by Moose's grandmother, Donna Hayes. I bring audio from the film and from a 2020 interview I did with Donna about her long struggle for justice, her work with Pacific Northwest Family Circle, and with her mother, Sylvia Dollarson, who died in December. Finally, Jan Hawkins speaks with director A.J. Wan about his new documentary, Diatribe, a loving tribute to Portland-based Ghanaian drummer and educator Obo Addy. The film, Jan notes, is a love story about hip-hop as an artistic form with deep roots in African movement and sounds. Jan and AJ talk also about another documentary about the African roots of American hip-hop, Moving to the Beat. First up, Bill Resnick.
James Offsink, welcome again to KBOO.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
James Offsink is a leader in the Portland organization, Portland Forward. James is a very active member of a network that includes Unite Oregon, Portland Cop Watch, the Unitarian Social Justice Committee, Pacific Northwest Family Circle, Jewish Voice for Peace, Jobs with Justice, Emerge, Street Roots, and many others. They're seeking nothing less than a reconstruction of Portland policing. When the network emerged in the wake of the George Floyd protests, it seemed that reconstruction of police was possible. The police were on the defensive, and Portland voters had shown considerable favor for police reform. By wide majorities, Portland voters had elected a new genuinely progressive prosecutor. And in addition, by a ballot initiative, they had authorized a citizen review board to review police action, and that board had real powers. For the Police Reform Network, the union contract that was then expiring was the next target. For some time, the contract provisions had made very difficult to impose meaningful discipline and made it very difficult to do anything about very questionable police shootings. Optimists among us believed that those provisions could be meaningfully altered, and optimists also believed that police were not the right people to deal with a host of social problems, like being first responders for mental health emergency and homelessness, often school disorder, addiction, and more. We believe these present police responsibilities should be transferred to others better suited and trained to intervene, taking funds from the police budget to fund these services. Indeed, at the height of the protest, the city developed plans and proposed appropriations for some of this. But the mass George Floyd protest died down, the city's contract negotiations with the police union began, and now, months later, nearly all of the promises the police made during the George Floyd struggles were forgotten. In addition, the city council had changed membership, and what had been a majority receptive to police reconstruction, unfortunately, decidedly changed. James Offsink, tell us about what the network was seeking in the union contract and how the many objectives were dealt with in the negotiations.
Thanks, Bill. Really appreciate you having me back on to discuss this crucial issue for the city and for community safety overall. So as you mentioned, the Police Action Network put together a letter that was signed on to by over 75 groups that included neighborhood associations, labor, faith groups, community groups, culturally and ethnically specific groups from all across the city. And there were basically 11 demands included in that letter. Some of them, as you indicated, would have been really wholesale kind of reconstruction of especially police accountability mechanisms worked in the city. And others were smaller, but still would have been significant changes, like requiring mandatory drug testing after uses of deadly force. I think a few of the top priorities in the letter, if I were to just boil it down to a handful, would have been first, the process around the negotiation of the police contract was one that favored the community through a public and transparent process. The second I would list as enabling an effective system of civilian oversight. The third would be holding accountable officers for uses of excessive force or bias-based policing. The fourth would have been public accountability for misconduct, which included ending the so-called embarrassment clause, which I'll return to in a second. And the fifth would have been ending secondary employment and special duty, where basically the police are hired out to private employers, still wearing their police uniforms, but instead policing Apple or Nordstrom's or something like that. And we fared not great on most of these. I do think the city started out favoring some transparency in the contract negotiation process. There was open sessions where the community was invited to come and talk to the city about what was most important for the city to be representing in the new contract. Those took place, I believe, in late 2019. My memory might be off slightly, but the original contract was set to expire in June of 2020, and there had been a huge push, groundswelling of police accountability, including 2018 Commissioner Joanne Hardesty being elected and, running in part on her history as a police accountability advocate. And so there was a lot of public interest in this going into that process originally. And then with the pandemic, the city council signed a one-year agreement pushing the contract out till 2021. And as the process got pushed out, while the community was still invited in, there was much less of a push by the city to make sure that the community was able to see what was going on during the process. And ultimately, I think there were 6 sessions that the public was able to view. And at that same time, there were 6 sessions that happened behind closed doors. But then the remaining balance of 12 sessions or something like that happened all secretly. So it ended up that from the full, roughly, 24 sessions that they had or something, the public and the media we're only able to view the original half of the first half. And so I think that that really took some of the wind out of the sails for the city, be able to say with a straight face to the Portland Police Association, no, we know what the community wants. The community wants accountability. The community wants an effective system of civilian oversight where it's not police investigating police. And we're going to really go to the mat to make sure that we achieve that. You know, the city was not able to say that in the end, in part because it was structured such that the community could not see or participate in what was going on as the negotiations developed.
I'm really interested in one of the issues, which it seems to me goes right to the heart of the police power now, and the numbers of police and the over-policing of society. Let's talk about that, the effort to switch from police to various kinds of community programs that could do the job much better with regard to the homeless and mental health emergencies and many other issues.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I think you're right that discussing how the Portland Street Response and to a lesser extent the public safety support specialist programs, how those played out in the contract, I do think is an important bellwether for how did alternatives to our kind of carceral punitive system of criminal justice fare in this contract. At the highest level, looking at the contract, the city is going to pay out a lot of money. I haven't seen the final official numbers from the city budget office as to what this is expected to actually cost, but it opens with $5,000 per sworn officer immediate bonuses on the signage or the adoption of the contract, to be followed up by $2,000 per officer bonuses in January of 2024. And the city is saying this is important because of recruitment and retention problems and because they're having trouble finding people who want to be police officers in the city of Portland. But those numbers are really big, and they are bolstered by other types of financial incentives, including pay differentials for bilingual officers, pay differentials for additional educational attainments. And so there's a lot of money that is basically being given to the Portland Police Association in this contract. You know, back of the envelope calculations, probably close to $1 million a year in new kind of money, although I will be very interested to see what the city comes up with. The number could be, in fact, much higher. So there's a lot of money that the city is paying for this. And what did the city buy? I think that the city is going to say that they did buy some official status for those alternative to sworn armed officers responding to every situation. So the Portland Street Response is officially recognized within the contract. Previously, the police association was fighting and saying, you know, you can't do the Portland Street Response because it takes away duties that are exclusively granted to the Portland Police Association, to the police department. So it is good that the Portland Street Response is officially recognized, and that argument is taken off of the table for the police association. There is an interesting part of the contract that says that the city council cannot remove police officer positions and replace them with Portland Street Response positions. So that is officially barred within this contract, which is in some ways what community has been calling for.
James, one last thing. There were a few good items in the contract. Some things were, in fact, one. Some important things, it seems to me, but most of the recommendations were not even dealt with, much less discussed. But the struggle continues. Tell us what we can expect in the next couple of years.
Thanks. I do think your analysis of the outcome of the contract is largely right. I think from our network's perspective, that this was a missed opportunity. We did get some small gains, including laying the groundwork for the new civilian oversight system. But I think that's where I would start as far as things that KBOO listeners and active community members should watch. The process is playing out right now to design the new civilian oversight system. And I've been really encouraged by the community members who are serving on that body to design the new system, including longtime police accountability advocates. And they have meetings that are open to the public, and they are getting started right now with designing what the new oversight system will look like. And that is a way that community members can both keep informed on what things are going to look like and make sure that it's known that the community continues to support real police accountability, as the vast majority of voters did voting in the new accountability system. So making sure that the city kind of stays strong to that, because you're right that the Portland Police Association will continue to resist accountability at every turn. So I think that's kind of one area. Without getting too overtly political to your listeners, I do think that the upcoming city council elections is going to be a real time when police accountability is yet again on the ballot, with shadowy corporate-funded organizations like People for Portland beating the drum of law and order and trying to get people to see that less accountability and more police and an increase in the carceral state are a solution. And I know that KBOO listeners will stand up and reject the pessimistic messages of groups like People for Portland. And, you know, there are several candidates on the ballot who have been shown a long time interest and commitment to continuing to move forward police accountability. And there are candidates on the ballot who have demonstrated time and again to support less police accountability. So I think people really need to be cognizant of how significant those city council elections are. Similarly, we have a very reform-minded and accountability-minded district attorney right now. I would say probably top 10 in the entire country in terms of really trying to move to a different system of justice, one that is restorative and not just punitive and does not view people who have crossed the criminal justice system as completely disposable and expendable and, you know, whose lives don't matter, and instead tries to build a community, a system of restorative justice, and one where community members can be rehabilitated and reintegrated into society after running afoul of the criminal justice system. So I think continuing to support that type of district attorneying as opposed to the historic law and order version is going to be another important one. The Portland Police Bureau constantly puts up different directives that are up for review, and that's another opportunity for community members to try to influence and show support for doing the right thing at the city level and within the police bureau. There are some efforts in the state legislature. Right now we're in a short session through the end of the month. There are definitely continuing efforts to reduce bias-based policing and to put in place diversionary tactics to keep people out of incarceration. Senate Bill 1510-1510, the Transforming Justice 2022 Act, tries to reduce some especially racial disparities in the criminal justice system and increases funding for non-carceral forms of justice. So I think those are a few things. I would just encourage listeners to keep informed on what is going on in local politics. It's so easy to get pulled into the fights that are happening in Congress or elsewhere. And it really is these local offices, whether it's city council or DA or community actions in your neighborhood, even some of the things that happen at neighborhood associations, you know, end up being extremely significant to people in the communities, whether that's people who are experiencing houselessness or people who, whatever, are getting pulled over disproportionately for traffic infringements. So I can't encourage people enough to keep involved in local politics and local issues and continue to push for real justice for our community.
James, people can get involved very, very soon. In fact, tell us about the council hearings. There are two of them coming up on the 17th and 24th. They're going to be extremely interesting in terms of the testimony and the reactions of the various council members.
Yeah, going to the city council's website, and the first introduction of this proposed police contract will happen this coming Thursday on February 17th in the afternoon. You can sign up to testify on the council's website, and that is when the council will be hearing from folks whether people think that this contract is good or not. And I would encourage people, because I think it is likely that this contract will be voted through, that even if you don't like the contract, that you tell council specifically what it is that council should be doing and prioritizing, you know, in the future. If folks are uncertain that they have enough information to testify, I would really encourage you to look up the work of Alex Zielinski at the Portland Mercury. She has been closely following this contract negotiation throughout its entire length. She did a really good write-up when the proposed contract was released. I would encourage folks to check that out. And then the council will actually be voting on adopting the proposed contract next Thursday on the 24th. Typically, they do not take public input at that, but, you know, for community members who have the opportunity to watch it, it will still be instructive as to where the different council members, they'll make some kind of statement about why they're supporting or opposing the contract. And I think that will be really important to watch and to hold our elected officials accountable to their words in the future.
James Opston, really good talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me on again, Bill, and thanks for all that you've done to cover this issue. And I really hope that your listeners are also ready to lean in on creating justice.
Natasha Walton, say a name. Natasha Walton, say a name. Natasha Walton, say a name. Say a name, won't you say a name? A Tatiana Jefferson, a Tatiana Jefferson, a Tatiana Jefferson. Say a name, 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 say a name.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio in Portland, Oregon. Thanks to Desiree Helligers and Old Mole Bill Resnick for a great start to another episode of The Old Mole. It's KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills special programming drive. Starting February 13th through March 19th, listeners, family, friends, and neighbors will have the opportunity to support KBOO Radio, an important part of our community and an indispensable source of news, politics, and entertainment. KBOO is a nonprofit organization with 80% of our funding coming from our members. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, writers, and KBOO has trained thousands of people to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. And it's Valentine's Day, so what a better way to show your true love for community radio than by becoming a member today? While we aren't in the station to take your calls, you can show your support by giving online at kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44-321, or you can support the Postal Service and Community Radio by mailing your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Support KBOO, support Community Radio today. Now, it's back to today's episode of The Old Mole with host Desiree Helligers.
That was Janelle Monáe doing Say Her Name. Denise Morris, who's kindly pitching today's show, and Bill Resnick, who did an interview with James Offsink of Portland Forward. And just a reminder that the Portland Police Association contract is coming up for discussion, if not a vote, at Thursday's City Council meeting. Wednesday, February 9th of this past week marked the fifth anniversary of the killing of 17-year-old Quanis Moose Hayes by Portland police officer Andrew Hurst. Hayes was unarmed and on his knees when Hurst shot him three times. In recognition of what his grandmother Donna Hayes refers to as Moose's angel bursary, hourly online screenings of the film Hayes wrote called Silent Voices were organized for last Wednesday. The film depicts Moose's story alongside the stories of eight other individuals killed by Portland police, including Aaron Campbell, Bodie Phelps, Brad Lee Morgan, Christopher Kalonji, Jack Collins, John Ellifritz, Kendra James, and Merle Hatch. Produced by Open Signal in conjunction with Portland Playhouse, the play was co-directed by Portland photographer Kendall and Olivia Louise, who was also a camera operator and an editor on the film, and organized the film screening. The event was a fundraiser for Pacific Northwest Family Circle, an all-volunteer organization which provides community and support for Oregon and Washington families who've had family members killed or injured by police. Working alongside Donna Hayes in her long struggle for justice for Moose and other victims of the PPB's routine lethal violence was Sylvia Dollarson, Donna's mother and Moose's great-grandmother, who died this past December. In March of this past year, the city of Portland agreed to a $2.1 million settlement in a wrongful death lawsuit, about a quarter of which will go to legal fees. In an Oregonian article, Maxine Bernstein quoted Hayes' uncle, Stephen Hayes, who spoke of watching Andrew Hurst giving a deposition. Quote, "I sat across the room from him. That was one of the worst things I've had to endure, was this man not showing any remorse for killing one of my family members." Unquote. As Bernstein documented in the article, quote, "The family's lawyers hired forensic biomechanical engineer Jesse L. Wobrook, who reviewed the paths of the three bullets that hit Hayes and the teen's wounds," unquote, arriving at a conclusion that starkly differed from Officer Hurst's account of the shooting. Hurst, Bernstein also noted, was previously one of three officers involved in the lethal shooting of 50-year-old Merle Hatch. Bernstein wrote that Wobrook, quote, "found that Hayes was on his knees, his head and neck bent forward, and his torso leaning slightly forward to comply with the officer's orders to go down to his face when Hurst fired the shots. Bullets struck Hayes in the abdomen, torso, and head," unquote, when Hurst fired the shots. Bullets struck Hayes in the abdomen, torso, and head, unquote. In September 20th, shortly before the Portland debut of Silent Voices, I interviewed Donna Hayes in Cooch Park in Northwest Portland. Donna was accompanied, as she so often was, by her 77-year-old mother, Sylvia. Sylvia died a mere 8 months after the lawsuit was settled, and nearly 5 years after Moose was killed, begging the question of how many more years she might have had ahead of her were it not for the impunity that Portland police shooters routinely enjoy, even as the city continues to shell out millions in wrongful death lawsuits. Even as we focus on the PPB's death toll, those killed directly by the PPB bullets, it's also important to recognize that those same bullets often take years, if not decades, off the lives of family members who are forced to carry the weight of grief and trauma through their long struggle for justice. Donna talked about the importance of memorializing people whose lives were cut short by the Portland police.
Their stories needed to be told. It brings them back to life. So they get a chance to tell their stories, talk to their families.
Here's a clip from the opening moments of Donna Hayes' play, Silent Voices.
Year after year, we watch American citizens become silent, and people like me have to speak for those voices that were silent. Their lives were shortened through police violence. I often look all over the country at lives blinking out to the sounds of gunfire. I don't have to look far. Portland and its metro area hold silent voices, and I am willing to speak for them. I am now speaking for the dead.
In my 2020 interview with her, Donahue's talked about the process of writing the play.
People who I didn't know, I took newspaper articles, and I didn't take articles that where the police was just beating them down. I took articles where families and friends talked about them. I didn't want the play to be all boo-hoo and I'm crying about everybody. I wanted it to be lively. I wanted people to know what was taken away from us. It were alive people, real people, and they was removed from us.
And she spoke about the process of memorializing her grandson, Moose, who's forever frozen at the age of 17.
He was so easy to write about. Everybody else, I had family members I could talk to, because Moose was the easiest to write. That was my favorite grandchild.
And he would have just been 21 in August, is that right?
Yes, August 2nd would have been his birthday. I had promised him that I would take him to happy hour when he made 21, but needless to say, that didn't happen. And so my honor is the plate for him. And it got a chance to tell his story, the type of person he was.
Donna Hayes would go on to make a claim that I'd heard nowhere in press coverage of Moose's killing, that Hearst knew Moose.
But we got so many people that's just killed for no reason at all. If you got a person, like for instance, my grandson, who's working to do what you say, you telling him, raise your hand, crawl out, do these things. And
he was literally on his knees when he was shot.
Trying to do what they said, but it was too many voices coming at him. He was scared. He probably had his pants coming down. And Hearst killed him. And if people would read the public notice, Hearst knew him.
How did Hearst know him?
My grandson beat up one of his relatives at a fight. He was a kid. Okay, and Hearst knew him.
She spoke about being spurred into organizing as a way of coping with the death of her grandson.
Moose, everything I do is because of him. I really don't want to see somebody else join our club that nobody wants to be in. When I got in with Pacific Northwest Family Circle, one of the people that started it came to one of our visuals, and she pulled me aside, and she stopped me with all these tears. That's all I did from the moment I found out he was dead until I seen that woman. And she said, do something. Don't just sit and cry. Before I recognized the killing of people, it broke my heart, but I didn't reach out. And once it happened to me, I had no other choice but to reach out. My thing is, I don't want other people to have to join this crowd. Get out and fight before it happens to one of yours.
And she talked about organizing alongside her mother, Sylvia.
Mother, and what, she's 77? 77-year-old mother gets out. She actually was a person that marched with Martin Luther King back in Chicago. But me and my mother get in the mood, we get our staplers and our glue, and we put it all over the neighborhood.
And Donna spoke of her work with Sylvia, along with Jill Nicholson, launching the Portland car caravans, and the hope she took from seeing images of Moose and other victims of Portland police and lethal shootings from around the country, their names memorialized on walls and fences around the city during the height of the George Floyd uprising in Portland.
I love the sight of the Federal Building. I couldn't wait when I went through. I just filmed it. I thought it was beautiful. All the messages, letting people know. I love the ACAB. I love that. Every time I see a cop, when I'm on my megaphone, that's what I scream out. So I've seen paintings all over the city of my grandson. I went down a neighborhood, and it was a beautiful neighborhood, and they had a little park going down the middle of the street. And on every tree, from one end to the other, had a list of black names. You go around the other side, it had a list of black names. I took the caravan that way. And as we go down, I was screaming out, say their name. And the people in there came out in solidarity. The more people stand up and be educated, because some people need to be educated. And we put things on our car sometime that is educational. And that's the major thing. The play, the caravan, Pacific Northwest Family Circles, when they out protesting, all of it is education.
As we mark the fifth anniversary of the February 9, 2017 shooting of 17-year-old Moose Quantas Hayes, we remember also his great-grandmother, Sylvia Dollarson, who died in December. On January 7th, the Scanner News published reflections on the life of Sylvia Dollarson from activists with Pacific Northwest Family Circle, who remembered her as a community leader and elder. The Scanner piece notes that, quote, Mrs. Dollarson had always been an advocate and activist for social justice. In the 60s, she proudly took her newest baby and other children to march with Dr. Martin Luther King in Chicago. Throughout her life, she fed houseless people weekly and some even daily out of her own personal budget. And last year, she co-led the Black Lives Matter Car Caravan PDX event to raise awareness of institutional and interpersonal racism during the George Floyd uprisings. Mrs. Dollarson was a pivotal elder in our organization, it goes on to say, quote, she was a woman of great strength, wisdom, and generosity. She was fierce and fearless, too. Pre-COVID, she and her daughter, Donna Hayes, would host our monthly meetings in person, arranging for the meeting room and feeding everyone. We remember her to be rather quiet most of the time. When she did choose to share her thoughts, though, they were always informative and influential. Her presence, humor, and leadership in Pacific Northwest Family Circle will be sorely missed. We are grateful for the time she shared with us. May she rest in peace. To find out more about the work of Pacific Northwest Family Circle, go to pnwfamilycircle.org. That's pnwfamilycircle.org. Donna Hayes' play, Silent Voices, is available for viewing on YouTube. This Valentine's Day segment is dedicated to Donna Hayes with love, condolences, and much respect. This has been Desiree Hilligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Before there was Trayvon.
Kill, they get away with murder. Plant the evidence at the scene, throw away burner. They'll say they felt their life was in imminent danger. Another sister or brother slain by a stranger. Murder one of us every 28 hours. Undeclared warfare, that's white power. If you're indigenous or African American, they use the media to assassinate your character. For it to make sense, I'd have to be convinced they're predators amongst us with malevolent intent. I could have a confrontation at a moment's notice. Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, Keaton Otis, James Perez, and Kendrick James, Deontay Keller, too many names, Oscar Grant, and Aaron Campbell. How we gonna set a different example?
Is pacifying the masses with sadistic tactics. Communities live in fear, wondering how many will die this year and how many more will remain silent in the face of violence. People hold their breath, knowing it's liberty or death. Headhunters, decapitating movements, breaking nations into fragments, and race are said to be coincidence rather than evidence. That the state of the nation is extermination. Blood of fathers, brothers, sisters, mothers, meaning America, from Oakland to Providence, forced silence, government-funded violence. Armed forces are targeting melanin once again, and homicide is justified when it's genocide, but how many more black folks are going to be crucified for the sins of America?
February 28, 1996, my son Deontay J. Keller was pulled over by Portland police officer Terry Krueger. Unfortunately, he jumped out the car and ran. Unbeknownst to him, a shot was fired, and he was shot in the back. But he continued to run, even though no shots fired call was called into the dispatch. Police found Deontay about three houses down in the backyard, lying face down, but he was still breathing. They handcuffed him and called for medical. Medical arrived at 2:23 a.m., but the police would not allow the medical to come in until 3:41. Within that time frame, Deontay died.
Because there was Trayvon.
You are listening to Before There Was Trayvon, which is a song by Jobene Keller, and it's dedicated to his son, Deontay J. Keller, who was shot in the back by Portland police officer Terry Krueger on February 28, 1996. The song features an all-star Portland lineup, including Taria Autry and Mike Crenshaw. Before that, we heard audio from a 2020 interview with Donna Hayes and from her film, Silent Voices. Next up, Jan Hawkins speaks with AJ One about his documentary, Diatribe, and about the legacy of Ghanaian drummer and educator, Obo Addie.
Welcome to KBOO, AJ One.
Thank you for having me.
Several weeks ago, you joined me on the Old Mole to talk about your film, Diatribes. It was wonderful to see the screening of the film as part of the Cascade Festival of African Films this month.
Yes.
A Diatribe, for those who haven't seen it, it's a loving tribute to Portland-based Ghanaian drummer and educator Obo Addie, who died in 2012. The film also dives into the African movements and sounds that have shaped the style and language of American hip-hop. Diatribe showcases Mike Crenshaw and other Portland hip-hop artists and creates a dialogue through music and dance to the African continent. So let's talk today about your work in an earlier Portland-based film on hip-hop that I was involved in some years back, Moving to the Beat, and some of the parallels with your Diatribe project. So what are your thoughts? Do you want to maybe start with your take on what Moving to the Beat is about?
Well, it had my homeboy in there, Abdul, who
Abdul Fofana, co-director.
Abdul Fofana, that's right. That's my co-director, and that is my brother. We were moving to the beat years ago when I first met him, and he would tell me stories that were included in the documentary. And he is an example of someone who came from Sierra Leone. I came from West LA. We got together. And based on stereotypes and ideas that we had about each other before we started talking, this is the friction and tension between America and Africa based on media-driven stereotypes and the things that we're raised to insult each other and that kind of thing.
You mean stereotypes both of people who live in African countries or immigrants, as well as urban blacks in this country.
Right. So for instance, being referred to as an African is the worst thing that you can be called in America. You take that as an insult, and those are fighting words. And for many in America that grew up in the public school systems nationwide would use that, you're an African. What? Those are fighting words right there. And it's based on media-driven tropes and stereotypes. The only way to break that down is to have conversations and realize that there are way too many more similarities than there are differences. So when I spoke with Abdul and we shared our stories, he had a much rougher go with things and visions that he had seen. And I couldn't compare. I was just like, okay, you win. Okay.
Coming out of the Sierra Leonean war.
Exactly. And it's not to be taken lightly. So it was the fact that we started to, I loved Moving to the Beat. Let's put it that way. I love Moving to the Beat. And I noticed the similarities. There were many parallels between what the purpose of Diatribe was with your film.
Can you say a bit about that? Kind of that related to that dialogue across differences, or finding commonalities across differences that also acknowledge perhaps that there are differences in immigrants coming out of different places in Africa and the trauma and life experience they've had, as well as the trauma and life experience of many American Black youth.
Right. Poverty has a way of getting us some type of solution to get out of the conditions that we're in. And oftentimes the only thing left is expression. So moving our hands and feet to get up out of an oppressed state, if it's through dance and drumming and rhythm and poetry, we have to use these forms of expression because of the hurt and the suffering and the trauma of being in the conditions that we're in. Politics is very important. But for those that are not informed politically, they have to learn how to transform creatively through poetry and rhythm. Those are used as tools of resistance, you know, of expression. So those are the similarities there. Oboe, even saying that name is just, I know how he felt. We sat down and we talked about things and he wanted to share stories, but in between the stories, there was the pain from the neglect or the disregard of what his value really is in the community. And due to some of the broken promises that he had experienced from other folks that wanted to do documentaries and interviews and things like that, they didn't have the staying power to go to the end. And it's either them having to figure out a way to escape by giving some type of stereotype on him. There's a poem at the end of the documentary where I say he's either too African or not African enough for America, and he's too Americanized for Africa. Criticism abound all over town, but the only true concern was sound. That was it. That's all that he wanted, and he wanted to just play his drums. He had an album that was called Let Me Play My Drums, and that's how he felt, but he had to deal with the disenchantment of the lack of support and engagement from the community. And he wanted to find somebody that can articulate that in a resisting kind of way.
And in a way, you brought out the resistance in his sound and maybe channel something that, I mean, I had heard him many times, but didn't connect him at all with hip hop, which in Moving the Beat, you know, at one point, Abdul says, he likes Movie the Beat because it's brutally honest.
Right.
brutally honest. And right. There is, I think, an aggressive in your face, I'm not going to tone down my words.
Right.
Aspect to hip hop that has connected it with forms of insurgency, forms of rebellion that Oba'adi was not connected in most people's minds with Black liberation. Can you say a little bit about, I mean, you were trying to bridge that divide, but there maybe is an irreducible difference between some aspects of hip hop and Oba'adi's style.
Right. High life. High life was the style. That super fast.
So that's called high life?
Right. High life is that highly charged, rapid fire drumming that you hear. And that is a reflection of the running, the escaping, the fighting. You see, it's like a war call. It's time, like taps. This would be the equivalent of being in battle, getting ready to get in and get down. So his connection with Mike Crenshaw, when we talk about resistance, when we talk about hip hop and lyricism and strong masculinity, you put Mike Crenshaw there. And that's where that initial connection had come with him, because he's going to get everything that he wants when it comes to that strong high lifestyle lyricism, because that's what Mike Crenshaw is.
Are you saying there are ways of listening to Oba'adi's drumming that you have to learn how to listen to it because there's a call in it as well?
Right. So we go to the pre-show of the performance at Hollywood Theater. Alex Adi, Okule, the rest of the brothers there.
That was wonderful, by the way.
And it's wonderful because of what? Because that drum is vibrating within your heart. You hear it and it syncopates with your own heartbeat, right? And it makes you feel something. You don't know what it is, but it makes you feel the way. It makes you smile. It makes you tap your foot. It makes you snap your fingers. And this is a cosmic connection that comes from the root. This is the ancient African oral tradition. And to be able to have that reverberate in a room, be it a theater, an amphitheater, a stage, or on a corner, or in the village, this is the expression that brings us to a point of being able to understand what it is to be connected within.
And that's all movements require that kind of calling to wake up, be alive, be together. I wanted to touch more, have you respond to a theme you just fleetingly mentioned a bit ago on masculinity. And when I put up a lot of the support for several of the trips of that team to go to Freetown, and I said to the crew and the team, I said, I want to see some women when you come back. I don't want to only see men. And I said, I know there's some great guys there doing this work, but I want you to find women hip hop artists. And they did. And they talked about that. I don't know if you remember that theme, but I think it expanded hip hop for a lot of the young women who've seen that film to relate to it as a kind of subversive notion of femininity or womanhood as well as rebellious masculinity. Can you say anything about that theme?
Women are warriors too. As a matter of fact, women are the first warriors. They have to go through the process of childbirth. That's war. there's lots of resistance, blood. There's
having to be comfortable with the raw side of life.
You speak from experience, you know.
Yeah. Well, you may not know this, but Moving the Beat started out of a film where I interviewed and followed and filmed many of the mothers of these young people, Abdul's mother, looking at women's perspectives on the Sierra Leonean Civil War, bringing women's voices to problems of warfare. And it was called Diamonds, Guns, and Rice. My first film that I did with my son when he was in high school. And it's also on my website. But when we were showing that, including at the Cascade Festival of African Films, there were a lot of young immigrants who said, our experience is different from our mothers. We have a different take on things. And so the Moving the Beat came out of an intergenerational dialogue, basically, among Black parents and children and some gatherings and immigrant Black children and their parents on how to make sense of the world through music and older people trying to understand hip hop and being less afraid of it. Because initially, many of these mothers and fathers were afraid of hip hop and their kids becoming Americanized in the wrong way. So it was kind of an educational experience all the way around. And so we might continue with something on cross-cultural and cross-generational dialogue.
We still didn't talk about the soundtrack. There's 32 tracks on this soundtrack, and everything that you're sharing right now is part and parcel, was comprised of both volumes of the soundtrack. It's Oboe's story and my story combined, because the documentary just was not enough. Oboe needs to be fleshed. His entire story needs to be fleshed out. The musical stage production that we saw bits and pieces of needs to be fleshed out. My connection and what I was trying to do historically, showing the connection of African contribution to the evolution of hip hop dance through the use of 20s and 30s archival footage from the Nicholas Brothers and Berry Brothers, that needs to be fleshed out. The purpose is, when we lack resource, we still have to find a way to get to the end, and then we will adjust on the fly in the future, because that's what it is. This is what happens when we plant seeds. There's going to be weeds, there's going to be bad flowers, but we have to make sure that we till the soil and get that proper light, that sun, that photosynthesis going on. And that's what we saw on February 4th. But there's still so much more to do. So if I could say a little bit of what I would like to see.
What would you like to see next?
What I would like to see next is that any listener or any viewer that is watching this right now, I would like for you to identify your strength or your contribution to help push this movement. This is not just a documentary we're talking about. We're talking about a movement that comprises of education and entertainment. So we're going to be able to get into the educational system and still provide something that is healthy and of historical significance. You see, we want to teach people the connection of where the rhythm came from.
That's also joyful and pleasurable to watch, which I think that was a guiding idea for both Diatribe and Moving the Beat, that they not come through as after school specials.
Right.
You know, they're fun to watch. And, you know, there were some teachers at that screening on Friday who clearly were interested in taking your project to the schools. So let's return to that in a later program. How do you?
That's right, Dr. Hocken.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay, Dr. One. We will continue with this. Well, thank you so much for being with us today and for your beautiful film, such a tribute to Oba Addy and the Portland crew of hip hop artists and your own work that continues in LA. And we look forward to having you back on the show. And thank you for your comments on Moving to the Beat as well.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, K-Boo. This is my second home. I love everybody on the staff and I will be back. I will continue to be back until you say you've been here enough. Please don't keep coming here. I think we've covered everything. And I'll say, no, we didn't. We'll never cover everything. I'm coming back again.
West Africa.
There's a beat inside of each of us, and we all have to listen to that beat. And this is something bigger than just hip hop. This is something that we all need to listen to and make a conscious effort to move across boundaries, move across racial stereotypes, move across sexism, and make a move to make a change, to reach out. We can change this world one step at a time. If we listen to that beat that's inside of each one of us.
That was a clip from the documentary film Moving to the Beat, available on Vimeo and talked about just previously in the interview between Jan Hocken and AJ One. Before we sign off for the day, I want to remind listeners on February 13th, KBOO kicked off our All Thrills, No Frills special programming drive. Everything you hear on KBOO is, in its own way, special programming because we are a volunteer-powered, member-driven community radio station, and we need your support to keep it going. Information on that special programming can be found on KBOO's website, homepage kboo.fm. These are trying times indeed, and this morning I want to encourage listeners to support KBOO Radio and programs like The Old Mole. We are volunteer-powered, non-commercial, independent, member-supported community radio, and we need your support to keep it going and keep KBOO on the air for another 50 years. Supporting this vital resource in our community is just a click away. Donate today at kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44-321 or mail your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast Avenue in Portland.
So thanks again to Denise Morris for pitching today's show. And before that, Jan Hocken interviewing AJ One about his new film Diatribe, about the legacy of Oba Addy. Thanks to Jan Hocken for that segment and also to Bill Resnick for his interview with James Offsink of the organization Portland Forward, part of Portland's Police Reform Coalition. Thanks also to Denise Morris for producing today's show. This is Desiree Helligers, and I've been your host. We're going to play out today's V-Day show with Janelle Monáe doing Say Her Name.
Michael, won't you say her name?